From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Well, first of all, happy birthday to my mother. Her birthday was Saturday, and also to 86-year-old Tony from Northport, New York. Happy birthday to you too, Tony. Later, who's behind the secret door? Three special mystery guests. And also, I hope you had an enjoyable Memorial weekend with your friends and family. And of course, you know the sole purpose, to remember our fallen soldiers who give us the freedom to enjoy our weekends. More on that in a moment. Here's what's happening. Problems in Germany. Germans have been warned not to eat cucumbers until tests identify the source of a deadly E. coli outbreak, which local officials say has killed 14 people. It is thought the contaminated cucumbers were imported from Spain, but further tests are being carried out right now. Germany has registered already 1,200 confirmed or suspected E. coli cases so far. The cases reported in Sweden, Denmark, Netherlands, the UK, Germany is set to hold crisis talks later on this situation. Europe's economic powerhouse, Germany, has also announced plans to abandon nuclear energy over the next 11 years, outlining an ambitious strategy in the wake of Japan's disaster to replace atomic power with renewable energy sources. And two workers from Japan's stricken plant have been contaminated by high levels of radioactive iodine, prompting fears over their long-term health. The workers, reportedly men in their 30s and 40s, may have already been exposed to radiation levels higher than the recently boosted official annual limit. Dr. Robin Falkov on the line with us here. She has been following this situation for some time. Robin, the radiation levels, I fear, are much higher than they've reported. What have you found?
Most definitely, George. I mean, there are reports from the Hawaiian growers, the dairy farmers, that they were measuring on May 10th that levels were 400 to 2,400 times the normal levels. And they've taken precautions by adding boron, sodium borate, and kelp to the feed for their cattle. And there are monitoring stations around the world and showing maps of the United States where people with equipment are able to post the information. So we're not getting accurate information. And we look at the news, the headline that you just read, George, and I did a timeline, a real brief one, just to give two other data points beyond today. So we had on the 18th, where they were talking about the heroic workers ignoring the risk, which I'm sure everyone remembers that they went in. There were 180 workers in groups of 50. And then another update on April 1st, where a mother is talking about expecting her son to die. That's what he told her, because they had to sacrifice themselves to do what they could to contain the radiation. So now when they're telling us that there are only two workers who have had exposure over 250 millisieverts, it's questionable unless everybody's taking that new drug, X-RAD, that is supposed to treat radiation before exposure and after.
Well, we're going to watch this. Robin's website, healthfreedomrights.com. Thank you so much, Robin. Health officials in South Korea reported that a second person has died after being infected with an unknown virus. Here we go. Eight patients from different parts of the country have been hospitalized in recent months with a similar cold or flu-like symptoms. In a new report, a large group of American doctors are urging kids and teens to avoid energy drinks and only consume sports drinks in limited amount. The recommendations come in the wake of a national debate over energy drinks, which experts fear may have side effects. The forecast for the summer driving season: hit the road early, not to beat the traffic, but to beat the higher gas prices expected in mid-July. Goldman Sachs, looking into their crystal ball, they think oil will soon soar to $135 a barrel and likely have service stations jacking up fuel prices to $5 a gallon, just like the summer of 2008 that preceded the recession. The Space Shuttle Endeavour and its six astronaut crew said farewell to the International Space Station for the final time, casting off on a journey home after the shuttle's last visit to the orbiting outpost. Endeavour undocked from the space station on time after spending nearly 11 days parked at the massive complex. science advisor and head of the EnterpriseMission.com, Richard C. Hoagland. Well, it's kind of a somber feeling, isn't it, Richard?
It really is. I mean, you look at this incredible, magnificent machine which we created, which is the linear descendant of, you know, Kennedy's vision, the Saturn V, the control of liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, which is the most powerful chemical fuel you can use to go from here to the moon or here to Earth orbit. And you're watching this incredible winged vehicle that we created 30 years ago, which has a lot of life left in it. And I must say, I'm kind of sad, because after this and the next mission, there's nothing. And that's not what a great nation, the United States of America, should be doing. We should be aggressively pursuing, for instance, all that water they announced on the moon.
You know. As you said the day before, by the way.
Well, all that water is literally worth its weight in iridium. The single largest problem in establishing human habitation on the moon, a moon base, hotels, the vision of Arthur Clarke and Stanley Kubrick, the film 2001, all those things that we grew up thinking were going to be in our future, the single biggest stumbling block is the economics of establishing space transportation with chemical fuels. Now that the moon is dripping wet, as wet pound for pound as the Earth, if not more so in some places, all those economics are totally changed. Everything we thought we would grow up doing, we could be doing if we had leadership in Washington that said this nation, like Kennedy, must sail first on this ocean because we cannot be second. If we're second, the human race suffers. So I'm waiting with bated breath to see who will be in leadership as we approach the election of 2012 and announce the continuation of the great human adventure that seems to be coming to an end tonight.
And we will need it indeed, Richard C. Well, it's singer Sean Kingston. He's in stable condition tonight at a Miami hospital where he was admitted following a jet ski accident. His publicist said the 21-year-old was reportedly in critical condition on Sunday at a hospital after his jet ski crashed into a bridge. He had a passenger with him. After reportedly being discovered on MySpace, Kingston, whose birth name was Kisan Anderson, had global success with the song you just heard, Beautiful Girls, which was released in 2007. PBS officials say hackers have cracked the network's website, posting a phony story claiming dead rapper Tupac Shakur was still alive in New Zealand. And a group that claimed responsibility for the hacking complained about a recent Frontline investigative news program on WikiLeaks. Tupac was gunned down in Las Vegas in 1996. Americans from the nation's capital to Alaska marked Memorial Day with parades, somber reflection, and even climbing an expedition in a holiday infused with fresh meaning by the approaching 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. The National Memorial Day Parade in Washington honored veterans and Americans war dead, but also featured special tributes to the 9/11 first responders as well, victims and their families. Now, the numbers of American soldiers that have died in wars from 1775, American Revolution, through 1991, the battle deaths in service theater, as they call it, close to a million soldiers have died from that time period, 1775 to 1991. Non-theater deaths from the same period, about 230,000 people. In warfare, theater is defined as a specific geographical area of conduct of armed conflict bordered by areas where no combat is taking place. Now, another 6,000 men and women have died in Afghanistan and Iraq wars, our soldiers. And don't forget Canadians and other allies that are not included in these figures. Each Memorial Day, I play my rendition of A Soldier Died Today by A. Lawrence Vaincourt. He was getting old and punchy, and his hair was falling fast, and he sat around the Legion telling stories of the past, of a war that he had fought in, and the deeds that he had done, and his exploits with his buddies. They were heroes, everyone. And though sometimes to his neighbors his tales became a joke, all his buddies listened, for they knew where if he spoke. But we'll hear his tales no longer, for old Bob has passed away, and the world's a little poor, for a soldier died today. And now he won't be mourned by many, just his children and his wife, for he lived an ordinary, very quiet sort of life. He held a job, he raised a family, quietly going on his way, and the world won't notice passing, though a soldier died today. You know, when politicians leave this earth, their bodies lie in state, while thousands note their passing and proclaim that they were great. Papers tell of their life stories from the time that they were young. The passing of a soldier, it goes unnoticed and unsung. The politician's stipend and the style in which he lives are sometimes disproportionate to the services that he gives. While the ordinary soldier who offered up his all is paid off with a medal, and perhaps a pension, small, so it's easy to forget them, for it was so long ago that our Bobs and Jims and Johnnies and Jessicas went to battle, but we know. It was not the politicians with their compromise employees who won for us the freedom that our country now enjoys. Now, should you find yourself in danger with your enemies at hand, would you really want some cop out with his ever waffling stand? Or would you want a soldier who has sworn to defend his home, his kin, his country, and fight until the end? It was just a common soldier, and his ranks are growing thin, but his presence should remind us that we may need his like again. When his countries are in conflict, then we find the soldier's part is to clean up all the troubles that the politicians start. If we cannot do him honor while he's here to hear the praise, then at least let's give him homage at the ending of his days. Perhaps just a simple headline in the paper that might say, "Our country is in mourning, for a soldier died today." More on our Memorial Day tribute in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. This hour, of course, we are devoting it to our Memorial Day coverage here. Although it has more recently been the name of an attack submarine, the USS Indianapolis is most associated with the World War II ship that was lost just days before the end of the war and the story of those who survived. Just after midnight on July 30th, 1945, the Indianapolis, carrying 1,197 sailors and Marines, was torpedoed by a Japanese submarine. The heavy cruiser, on its way back to the Philippines after delivering components for the atomic bomb, went down in about 12 minutes. About 900 crewmen survived the sinking. Some were in lifeboats, but most bobbed in the water only with life jackets, hoping, waiting to be saved. Listen to a scene from the classic movie Jaws as Quint, played by Robert Shaw, tells the story.
Japanese submarine slammed two torpedoes into our side, Chief. He was coming back from the island of Tinian, the lady just delivered the bomb, the Hiroshima bomb. 1,100 men went into the water. Vessel went down in 12 minutes. Didn't see the first shark for about half an hour. Tiger, 13-footer. You know that when you're in the water, Chief? You tell by looking from the dorsal to the tail. Well, we didn't know. Was our bomb mission had been so secret. No distress signal had been sent. They didn't even list as overdue for a week. Very first light, Chief. Sharks come cruising. So we formed ourselves into tight groups. You know, it's kind of like old squares in a battle, like you see in a calendar, like the Battle of Waterloo. And the idea was, shark comes to the nearest man, that man, he start pounding and hollering and screaming. Sometimes the shark go away. Sometimes he wouldn't go. Sometimes that shark, he looks right into you, right into your eyes. You know the thing about a shark? He's got lifeless eyes, black eyes, like a doll's eyes. When he comes at you, he doesn't seem to be living until he bites you, and those black eyes roll over white, and then, oh, then you hear that terrible high-pitched screaming. The ocean turns red, and in spite of all the pounding and the hollering, they all come in and they rip you to pieces. You know, by the end of that first dawn, Lost 100 men. I don't know how many sharks. Maybe 1,000. I don't know how many men. They average 6 an hour. On Thursday morning, Chief, I bumped into a friend of mine, Herbie Robinson from Cleveland. Baseball player. Bosun's mate. I thought he was asleep. Reached over to wake him up. Bobbed up and down in the water. It was like a kind of top. Upended. Well, he'd been bitten in half below the waist. Noon the fifth day, Mr. O'Berry, Lockheed Ventura, saw he swung in low and he saw us too. A young pilot, a lot younger than Mr. Hooper anyway, he saw us and he come in low. And 3 hours later, a big fat PBY comes down and start to pick us up. You know, that was the time I was most frightened, waiting for my turn. I'll never put on a life jacket again. So 1,100 men went in the war. 360 men come out. The sharks took the rest June the 29th, 1945. Anyway, we delivered the bomb.
Pretty graphic, but that'll tell you some of the things that our soldiers, sailors, Marines went through to bring you freedom. Douglas Dietrich, son of a retired U.S. Navy sailor. Douglas worked for 10 years as a Department of Defense research librarian, where one of his major duties was document destruction. He then experienced the 1991 Kuwaiti campaign, serving a Desert Storm as a United States Marine. Douglas has studied the historical process of the sacrifice of those on the USS Indianapolis, her captain, her crew, following delivery of those components critical to the deployment of the atomic bomb. Here is Douglas Dietrich this hour. Douglas, what a story. What a story.
Yes, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to share it with everyone in our audience, Mr. Norrie. It's always great to be here, and really great to hear about your mother's birthday. I want to thank the Coast to Coast AM audience for all the prayers they gave my mother during her time of passing.
Douglas, this story illustrates just one of the many unbelievable heroic things that our men and women went through during all these wars.
Yes, and I'm glad that you brought up the Veterans, the Memorial Day. It's a hard day for me as well, because I was just out there at the Presidio today, and we had one of the largest Memorial Day celebrations and parades in the nation in the cemetery here. And a lot of people were arguing about the different fatality statistics, which you were kind enough to bring up. And just keep in mind that a lot of these statistics just get skewed for different reasons. And I'll get into the Indianapolis right now as part of that process, because a lot of the men and soldiers who die in Iraq, for instance, a lot of them are flown to Germany, and a lot of them get injuries where they die later on in Germany, and they're not counted as battlefield fatalities. But with the Indianapolis, what we had was something very specific, very different. It was a very special mission, a very critical mission. At the same time, unfortunately, there was a dichotomy between what the civilian command under Harry Truman, who had just become president, had understood, and what a lot of the old, more conventional Navy High Command and U.S. Army High Command were thinking. General Curtis LeMay himself really didn't take the atomic bomb seriously. He thought he was doing a lot of damage with incendiary firebombing. He thought of the atomic bomb as simply a physics bomb, a kind of different kind of firebomb. So no one was really putting any effort into security consciousness when the Indianapolis was sent out from Mare Island, San Francisco, where I'm at today, not at Mare Island itself, but of course in the city. I was at Mare Island earlier today. But on July 16th of 1945, the Indianapolis, flagship of the United States 5th Fleet in the Pacific, heavy cruiser, was sent out carrying the components and the enriched uranium of the Little Boy bomb to Tianan Island, where it was to be delivered. And it was sent without escort. Unbelievable. And it brings to mind the USS Hood, which the British had known about for years as needing heavy armoring, but they just kept putting off the repairs or the reinforced armoring that was needed on the USS Hood, and just kept telling the captain of the Hood, speed is armor, speed is armor. And of course, a lucky shot was sent out by the Bismarck that sunk the Hood and over 1,000 crewmen with it. This is kind of what happened with the Indianapolis. The Indianapolis was told to go at full speed. to Tianan Island. And when it reached Tianan Island and delivered the bomb, it was not given any information concerning what American signals intelligence units already knew about the submarine that was going to sink it.
And Douglas, if the ship, if the USS Indianapolis had not gotten there with the components for the atomic bomb, I want you to tell us what could have happened. We'll be back in a moment with Douglas Dietrich as we talk about the USS Indianapolis this Memorial Day night. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, who's behind the secret door? We'll have three guests throughout the night. I have no idea who they are. We'll take phone calls with them as well. We'll figure it out together, won't we? Up next, we'll be back with Douglas Dietrich as we talk about the USS Indianapolis. What an incredible story. Next on Coast to Coast AM. And in a moment, we'll take some of your calls with historian Douglas Dietrich as we talk about the USS Indianapolis. Douglas, had it gotten sunk before they delivered the components, what would have that done to the war effort?
Well, the war effort would have continued, and it was heading towards an apocalypse. We have to remember that so far they had a Germany-first policy under Roosevelt, which had dominated the American mobilization effort, so that, as unbelievable as this may seem to the American public, after Pearl Harbor, only 15% of America's war economy, its troops, its equipment, up to this point in the war in 1945, was going to the Pacific. And a total of one-third of that was going to the Alaskan front, where they were trying to defeat an invasion by Japanese Marines in the Aleutian Islands. So the war was just beginning. And on the very day of the Hiroshima bombing itself, on August 6th, the U.S. Army Chief of Staff, George C. Marshall, received a special report that told him about the Japanese divisions that were being mobilized. They had already mobilized 30 new divisions, which secured China. They had the manpower to mobilize at least 42 more on the mainland, 23 that were going to be deployed against the Americans themselves, and at least five armored divisions. And all of this was heading in the direction of the Americans. And what the Americans had been basically facing up to this point with the Japanese was the Japanese Navy and the Japanese Marine.
Why did the ship go down so quickly?
The ship went down so quickly because the ship was sunk by a secret Japanese weapon known as the Kaiten weapon, which the Americans did not want to bring up at Captain McVeigh's court-martial. And that's part of the travesty of what happened. Captain McVeigh was not given information concerning the I-58 in that area. He was not given any escort. And when he left Tianan Island after delivering the bomb, basically he was hit by the I-58 launching suicide torpedoes, manned torpedoes, which it would have been impossible for him to evade, because they were guided by men.
What do you mean, man torpedoes? The men were in the torpedoes?
That is correct. This was the Kaiten. This has been brought up in several naval studies. It's the subject of enormous controversy. I can tell you for a fact that it did happen. We can go into that if some of the callers are interested, but the most important thing about it was, because of the nature of the weapon, the U.S. Navy did not want to bring this up at his trial. They did not bring up any of the intelligence of the information available from Ultra at his trial. He was very much railroaded. Even the captain of the submarine that sank him, the Japanese captain, Michisura Hashimoto, who after the ceasefire was brought into his trial to act as a witness against him, tried to inform the jury at his court-martial that there was nothing that Captain McVeigh could have done. And they just misinterpreted whatever he said in Japanese into English and said he had launched conventional torpedoes. And there was an enormous controversy concerning the trial later, which is why President Clinton, years later, exonerated Captain McVeigh. Unfortunately, it was too late for McVeigh, because after his prosecution, he was driven so much by the hounding of many families of the sailors who were on his ship under his command that he killed himself. Very sadly, very tragically. And there's a number of reasons why that travesty occurred. After he had delivered the bomb intact to Tianan Island, what had happened was they did send out a distress signal when they were sunk. We have to remember that when Jaws was written and Peter Benchley was writing the script, that they did not know this, because that was not released until maybe a few decades after Jaws was released. But the truth was, he sent out distress signals that were received by three different recipients in the U.S. Navy. One of the officers was dead-faced drunk. The other one was in a room with a prostitute and ordered his men not to disturb him.
Oh,
and another one basically thought it was a Japanese propaganda prank. And so no one sent any help to the Indianapolis, and the men were in the ocean, dying of dehydration. They were eaten alive by the largest shark attack in American history. And I do want to emphasize to the American people that this is the kind of image we have of the last major warship sunk in the Second World War. We have to remember the war with a feeling of solemnity because it is so analogous to the situation which America found itself in after World War II, which was not an overwhelming victory, but Korea and Vietnam and now Iraq and Afghanistan. We are still in that shark feeding frenzy in Asia. And he was one of the sacrificial victims of it, Captain McVeigh and his men. Think of the trauma they went through after being discovered strictly by accident by a PBY that spotted them, a Catalina on anti-submarine patrol, suddenly spots them and basically leads to their rescue, calls in the people, including one of the men who would later on become the Secretary of the Navy, who fly in and ultimately ahead of the ships try to strap as many men as they can onto the pontoons of their amphibious airplanes so that they can fly them to ships.
Because they all would have been wiped out, Douglas.
That is correct. They all would have been wiped out if it hadn't been for this timely accident, and nobody would have known what had happened. And but sadly, while this was going on, Truman, of course, who himself had been a former artillery officer, he understood what it was like in combat. He, unfortunately, was not in the United States. He was coming home crossing the Atlantic. And unfortunately, his staff was given a different story by the people on Tiananmen Island. See, what had happened was after the Indianapolis had dropped off the bomb, the Tiananmen Island people were working with Little Boy, and there was an accidental neutron surge, which went Cherenkov blue, a shade of blue you never want to see. People remember it from the movie about the Manhattan Project, where Dr. Lewis Slotin was the historical figure who was portrayed as melting down, so to speak, underneath radiation exposure from the bomb beginning to go critical in terms of its components. That's what happened with Little Boy. Jeez. And it destroyed the weapon's yield ability to the extent where not only did it kill a bunch of scientists who went through a horrible death, but Dr. Luis Alvarez had to insert all of the world's known supply of polonium into the core assembly so that the bomb would go off at all. This was the equivalent of injecting nitrous oxide.
I did not know that, Doug. Let's take a few calls here while we still have you. Let's go to Richard in Estacada, Oregon. Hey, Richard, thanks for calling.
Yes, I'm calling in with a question. Is my father came home from the European conflict in World War II, and when he passed away, in his drawer, I found a knife that I guess the soldiers wore on their side, and the name that's inscribed on the shaft of the knife is I'll spell it. It's C A T T A R A U G U S. And then it's 2250. Now, how would I find out anything about the history of that?
That, sir, would be something to consult an antiques expert about, especially one who deals in collectible militaria. Unfortunately, that's not exactly my specialty. I did a lot of document destruction, work with documents, which is how I can give a more strategic perspective on incidents like this that otherwise don't seem to make much sense. But it's certainly good that you're seeking, and I invite you to seek more information on that through people who deal in militaria, and that's what you would look up, people who deal in militaria either online or collectibles in the phone book. People who deal in antiques would direct you towards military specialists.
How come the world truly doesn't know about the USS Indianapolis story?
Because what had happened was it has such a shameful history to it. When Dr. Luis Alvarez did what he did because the little boy had been so compromised, he had to do that on the night before it was dropped over Hiroshima. He basically had broke all protocols. It was a significant breach of protocol because by using up all of the polonium plugs, that was all of America's accessible supply, there was no polonium left as a fissionable insurance if there ever was another uranium bomb. And Nagasaki was not a uranium bomb. It was a plutonium bomb, which is why the bombs look so different. But if they had another uranium bomb, they wouldn't have any fissile insurance to make it go off. And so he had to defend himself. And what he said was, it was Captain McVeigh and the Indianapolis. The boys, they jarred it all up and they dislodged the components. That was his excuse. And what they did was they ran Captain McVeigh up a rail. And so they just weren't going to accept anything that would have gotten McVeigh off the hook, even from the man who ran the submarine, who commanded the submarine, Hashimoto, that sank his ship. And that is a tremendous tragedy where we have bureaucrats and scientists who are shafting it to the men who fight for us.
Let's go to Harlingen, Texas. Glenn's with us east of the Rockies. Glenn, go ahead.
How you doing, George?
Good, thank you.
Sir, what is your name?
My name's Douglas Dietrich, sir, and I invite you to hit me up on Facebook.com/Douglas Dwayne Dietrich. I have to use my middle name because there's hundreds of Douglas Dietrichs out there. My middle name's spelled D-U-A-N-E. So please follow me on Facebook.com/Douglas Dwayne Dietrich. And that way you can also follow up on the book that is at the publishers right now. And also,
well, sir, my father was all 4 years on board a cruiser in the Pacific.
Yes, sir.
Cruisers were fast supply, used for fast supply, as well as bombardment like the battleships and escort.
Yeah.
And the Indianapolis was just on a clandestine mission. I've never heard such rabid anti-militarism and anti-Americanism in my life. I mean, George, I for one...
From who?
I think this is just a little bit too far.
From who?
Your guest.
No, he's not.
That's the way I see it.
On what? Give me one example. He's talking about what happened to the ship.
Well, it was on a clandestine mission.
Yeah, of course.
There was no one's fault, and the Japanese had.
Wait! The captain was court-martialed.
Yes, and.
I know that. But...
Yeah, don't forget, sir, that not only that, but the ship, when it did not arrive, was reported as having arrived. That is part of the problem. There was an enormous amount of incompetence and corruption that was going on in that theater, and there were plenty of good men in that theater. The overwhelming
amount. And, Doug, if I'm hearing you right, you're supporting the captain and the ship. And all the crew members.
I'm supporting the sailors, like the captain, and like my father, who was a sailor for over 30 years and three wars. You can visit my father's grave in upstate New York, and his tombstone, which is provided by the Veterans Administration, says World War II, Korea, and Vietnam.
Sometimes people just don't listen, Douglas.
I think because it is alarming to hear that this kind of political infighting and compromise goes on, people don't like to hear the fact that the team is divided. And what we have to remember is, even with the Vietnam Memorial Wall, it's not your U.S. government that set that wall up. It was a South Republican Vietnamese, by that I mean from the Republic of South Vietnam, a young Asian lady, an emigre, who valued the sacrifices that Americans made for her anti-communist republic so much that she organized the creation of that wall, not your U.S. government. Remember that, and it's up to us, all of us as individuals, to honor these servicemen, because oftentimes, sadly, our government does not.
You know, every Memorial Day, I try to at least take a portion of this program to remember our fallen soldiers, men and women. But you know what, Douglas? A lot of people still think Memorial Day is strictly barbecue.
It's very sad, and I do want people to understand that even in terms of the sacrifices we make, there are always people who are in the trenches with us. I appreciate the fact you brought up the Canadians and people from other countries.
Of course.
Obviously, I come from Taiwan, which was a rabidly anti-communist nation, but in terms of, for instance, World War II and the Pacific Theater, Americans tend to think they were in it all by themselves. The reality is, if you ask a British person about World War II in the Pacific, they're going to remember Imphal and Kohima, which no Americans ever heard of, but that was the equivalent in India of Stalingrad and Leningrad, where the British, using American Lend-Lease Sherman tanks, fought tremendous armored engagements with the Japanese and the Asian Indians who were fighting against British colonial rule. Massive engagements, totally unknown to American history, and most of the time, maps of the Pacific Theater that Americans produce don't even show India on the map. So
whatever happened to the captain afterwards?
So what happened to the captain was his court-martial was incredibly scandalous to the men like Chester Nimitz, who were in charge of the U.S. Navy during the—who were— who were in charge of large portions of the U.S. Navy during World War II. He wasn't up there with Admiral King in terms of running the entire fleet effort, but what Nimitz did was he used his own power to reinstate Captain McVeigh into active command. But it wasn't enough. McVeigh was continually harassed by many people because he had been publicly disgraced, and many Americans, sadly, held him responsible for the last loss of a major ship in World War II, and he ultimately was driven to suicide with his own Navy revolver, holding a toy sailor in his hand to represent all the sailors who had died before him. And this was in 1968, about 2 years after I was born.
Nancy's in Waterford, Connecticut, and she's up with us. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I appreciate your guest, who is talking about something that maybe not everyone, obviously, the previous caller, doesn't appreciate. But I think that it's important that we look at our veterans individually and not just as political entities, little puppets on a stage, so to speak. I think it's important that we look at them for what they do, per person. And this man, I think, had a lot of valor, and it's really unfortunate. But it's important that we hear his story, and so I'll be looking for that book. I wanted to comment to say honor to my dad, who fought in the Pacific during World War II. He was in the Army Air Corps, and he didn't do anything extraordinary, and he was just a gunner and those little round turrets that you might remember seeing in the planes, which I think was a very scary place to be. But he survived, and he wasn't never badly injured. I also wanted to mention the manned torpedoes that I guess one was used to bomb the Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
There were three of them.
Three of them.
I recently read a book about the bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And one of the survivors of Nagasaki was a boy, a little boy. He was only 8, being trained to man the torpedo because the people in the torpedoes had to be very small. So they liked to choose smart children, trainable children, or very tiny men. And the reason the boy survived the bombing was because he dove underwater and held his breath, because part of their training was to be able to hold their breath for a very long period. Because they were told that they were going to probably survive doing this. You're going to go bomb a boat and then swim to the surface. But, of course, mostly they were suicide bombers. But it's intriguing. I didn't realize that that's what was used to bomb the Indianapolis. But thank you very much for having your guest on tonight.
You're welcome. You're welcome. And, of course, we'll have our secret door guests in just a few minutes. Douglas, as we wrap this hour up, what are you working on these days?
Well, I want that young lady to know that certainly her father survived something that was statistically improbable. The people who were in the U.S. Army Air Corps bombing over the Axis had a far lower survival rate than U.S. Marines. And but in terms of herself, I appreciate certainly her observations on that. I would bring up the fact that what I'm trying to point out is that our men deserve the best, and a lot of the men who jumped off of the Indianapolis had lifesavers and life jackets that just didn't even inflate. And so this is the kind of quality equipment they were issued with that also led to a lot of deaths. But what I do want to say also in terms of what I'm working on is I invite her to pick up my DVD, Roswell and the Rising Sun, because it does speak a lot about the Hiroshima bomb and its impact on the war, exactly what direction that took. Another person who survived the atomic bombing was Imperial Japanese Army Field Marshal Shunroko Hata. And he automatically went to Tokyo and said, look, I survived it. It didn't even put a scratch on me. And it was absolutely true. He was right in the epicenter. So he survived just by that amazing fortuitousness. He told the emperor, we've got to keep this war going. So that's one of those ways. Many people, like prisoners of war who were in Hiroshima, survived because they had enough protection in their under the walls. It wasn't the massive destruction that people think, as horrible as it was. But this is explained in my DVD, Roswell and the Rising Sun. It's supposed to be a convention exclusive for ConspiracyCon. I will be speaking there. That's one reason why the U.S. military did not want to bring up the suicide torpedoes. it was considered an occult weapon. This is very difficult to explain, but this was how the Americans ran into the Japanese concept of occult warfare, and that was where they ran into the first acknowledgement of Kurumaku, or the Japanese concept of the Black Curtain, which was an organization that worked with harnessing occult forces. All of the kamikaze effort was geared towards that. The U.S. military wanted to keep that secret. They were investigating occult forces themselves. I speak of this at my presentation at ConspiracyCon number 11.
And, Doug, and Doug's website, by the way, is linked up at coasttocoastam.com as well. I'll be back in a moment as we go behind the secret door.